This is Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. I'm Jan van der Made in Paris.
I think he was a very faithful husband. I think he was absolutely astonished by his young wife.
16-year-old
second wife, that's for sure.
This is not ethical, this is not legal, this is not good ethics in Islam also, as we see it now.
Today we will bring you reports from all corners of Europe. We research democratic expectations of Ukrainians on the eve of parliamentary elections. In Sweden, an artist is under threat after drawing the Prophet Mohammed. We visit an art exhibition in Brussels and the devil is on show in Prague. We studied the popularity of rugby in Poland, and in France the price for bread, including the popular baguette, is going up. To the Ukraine first. Ukrainians head back to the polls on September 30 for fresh parliamentary elections that aim to end months of political deadlock and confusion. Many Ukrainians hoped that the Orange Revolution of 2004 would lead to political reform and stability, but those high expectations have waned. In the ensuing 3 years, the leaders of the Orange Revolution, who are advocating democracy and closer ties with the West, have fallen out with each other. And Ukraine's parliament has witnessed punch-ups, power cuts and party swapping, not to mention allegations of bribes and corruption. So what do Ukrainians think about their lawmakers and the Orange Revolution 3 years on? Deutsche Welle's Guy Dagen has been gauging the mood.
December 2004, a sea of Orange supporters in Kiev's Independence Square. Opposition leaders Viktor Yushchenko and Yulia Tymoshenko united in a fight against the Prime Minister and presidential candidate Viktor Yanukovych. It was scenes like this that captured the imagination of the world, the Western-leaning Yushchenko bearing the facial scars of poisoning versus the Russian-leaning Yanukovych and a rigged election. 3 years later, this triumph of people power and democracy for a post-Soviet country, as it was then hailed, has turned sour.
Сьогодні я підписав указ про дострокове припинення повноважень Верховної Ради України п'ятого скликання.
President Yushchenko explaining his decision to suspend the parliament in a televised national address in April. Any unity among Orange parties is long gone. Yushchenko sacked his Orange partner Yulia Tymoshenko as prime minister shortly after taking office in 2005. The loss of Tymoshenko meant the opportunity to carry out reforms they campaigned for largely disappeared. But Yushchenko's biggest worry is still Viktor Yanukovych, the man he ousted from the presidency. Yushchenko was forced to accept Yanukovych as prime minister last year. Since then, Ukraine has been in the grip of political infighting. Yanukovych is Ukraine's comeback man. His election campaign ads show him as a man who can get things done. But the paralysis of parliament and government infighting has left many voters less than optimistic about their politicians. In Kiev's Independence Square, Anne, a 21-year-old student, remembers the Orange Revolution well, but now questions if the upcoming elections will make a real change in Ukraine's politics.
I think it won't bring any real progress. I don't think it will be a backstep, but it's hardly a move forward. Maybe it will make everything a little more stable, but not solve the problems.
Vasenko, a keen blogger who witnessed the Orange Revolution protests, looks out over Independence Square sipping an espresso. Vasenko supported Yushchenko in 2004, but says he's now changed his mind.
I voted for Viktor Yushchenko because I believed for him, and many, many people believed in him. But now, the next election, I'm sure I shall vote for Yanukovych, and I think that this election will not improve situation in Ukraine.
Voters are not the only ones changing parties. Politicians are too. President Yushchenko has accused Yanukovych of bribing members to gain a majority in parliament.
И так, чтобы, так сказать, вы еще больше прониклись, я могу сказать следующее, что...
Natalia Prokopovich is a member of Yushchenko's Our Ukraine party and a strong advocate against corruption in parliament. Addressing a group of international journalists, Prokopovich says she has been offered several million dollars in bribes, but refrains from directly naming Yanukovych's party of the regions.
Who?
Outside the capital, though, particularly in the Russian-speaking East, it's easy to get a sense that the Orange Revolution may as well have happened in another country. The coal mining and steel region around Donetsk is Ukraine's industrial heartland and home to Viktor Yanukovych and his financial backer, Reinhard Akhmetov, Ukraine's richest oligarch. Coal miners Anton and Andrei tell of watching the Orange Revolution unfold on their TV screens in disbelief. They argue it was doomed from the beginning, as it did not reflect the feelings of all Ukrainians. Anton asserts that Yanukovych understands the workers, especially miners like themselves.
Yanukovych, because he promises to increase wages for miners. Everything depends on money, and he alone promises something for miners.
His workmate Andrei doesn't think Yushchenko or our Ukraine has been effective.
There's nothing good. He doesn't answer any questions. He answers questions with another question.
But if there's one region that is firmly behind the Our Ukraine party and President Yushchenko, it's Western Ukraine. In the city of Uzhhorod, Svetlana Metrayeva heads a government-funded think tank and regularly advises Yushchenko on foreign policy. She senses that the trust of voters in Ukraine's politicians is very low, and the political status quo is likely to remain.
There will again be the same parties, Our Ukraine, Party of the Regions, and Tymoshenko Bloc. I don't think there will be any changes after the elections. The only question is, what coalition will emerge?
Even if elections on September 30 do untangle the knot of Ukraine's political crisis and a working government is formed, the question of voter apathy with lawmakers is likely to remain. 3 years after the people power of the Orange Revolution, Ukraine is still viewed as a country in transition from its Soviet past. But the people may have to put up with corrupt and discredited politicians for the foreseeable future. Guy Deegan, Deutsche Welle Radio, Kiev.
The call by an Iraqi organization with links to Al-Qaeda to murder a Swedish artist and the chief editor of a provincial newspaper is still topping the headlines in Sweden. The call came in the wake of the artist's drawing of the Prophet Muhammad as a dog-like figurine decorating a traffic roundabout. Radio Sweden's Mark Cummings and Azaria Kairos compiled this story.
The call for the murders appeared on a website run by a little-known group which calls itself the Islamic State in Iraq and which claims close ties to Al-Qaeda. It's issued a bounty for the murder of the artist Lars Vilk and Ulf Johansson, editor-in-chief of the regional newspaper Nerikes Alejandra, for publishing the drawing. The offer is $100,000 for the murder of Vilks and $50,000 for Johansson. But the question is, how seriously should the threat be taken? Magnus Ronstorp is an expert on international terrorism at the National Defense College in Stockholm.
Well, I think it's always serious when you have, you know, a definable organization, particularly Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that actually pinpoints and specifically mentions both the artist as well as the chief editor of the newspaper. And I think it's very serious in that sense.
Some Muslim groups have accused Lars Vilks of exactly that, that his actions would only broaden the already wide gap between the Muslim and Western world. But Birgitta Börjesson, a researcher and lecturer at the School of Journalism and Mass Communications of the University of Gothenburg, argues that the Swedish Freedom of Expression Act is crystal clear on the rights of the individual.
The basics of freedom of expression in Sweden are very, very simple. As few limitations as possible, which means that we don't have very many limitations, at least not in peacetime. Basically, what comes to individuals, slander of individual persons, and it takes that it's severe things you say about people to even come near being taken to court for slander. It's free to say whatever you want in Sweden, and which also gives all those who don't agree with you the freedom to give their point of view.
The artist involved, Lars Vilks, has repeatedly said that he does not intend to give in to pressure from Islamic groups and has reiterated Sweden's commitment to freedom of expression, a view supported by media expert Birgitta Börjesson.
Lars Vilks is free to say whatever he wants. Whatever he wanted to say with this drawing, he's free to say it. Lars Vilks, as I have understood it, he made this sketch because he thinks that it's not possible to criticize at least some religions in Sweden today. That's why he did it. And he was stopped. There were art exhibitions and so on that didn't dare to show this. And that's why the paper published it.
Meanwhile, Swedish Muslim groups have also been quick in distancing themselves from the threat issued by the Iraqi group. And they've also been joined by European Muslim organizations in condemning the threat. I spoke earlier to Helena Bernauda, chairperson of the Swedish Muslim Council.
This is not ethical, this is not legal, this is not good ethics in Islam also, as we see it now. We have tried to collect Islamic organizations in Sweden to agree on in a common notice that we could send to different media and publish, telling that we are not agreeing on violent methods.
Did you get a feel for the reaction that other groups or the Muslim community in Sweden has had to this latest threat?
Well, we should first think about how badly Muslims felt in the beginning here in Sweden, how much they felt themselves threatened by, at least from the drawings. And still we kept us very, very calm in our attitude, in our ways of talking to Lars Vilks. It was very calm demonstrations, it was very calm writings. And we said that we are willing and wanting and demanding to talk in this way and keep this discussion and dialogue and in this way of peaceful methods, because this is hurting Muslims in Sweden first.
So how has the country dealt with the controversy? Has the let's talk to each other approach adopted by the government paid off? Or is it being seen as caving in to demands by some Muslim groups? Magnus Ranstorp, expert on international terrorism, says the government has passed this particular test with flying colours.
I think in terms of the government, I think the government has done the right thing in the sense of having a dialogue, particularly with the local Muslim community. The government has also not risen to the bait of creating confrontation when this threat came out. They really sidelined it. They really tried to silence it, not to give it any sort of dignity by commenting on it. And I think that's also a very good strategy. And of course, the Prime Minister and his government have had consultations with a number of ambassadors from Arab or Islamic countries. That's also very useful because they will also, of course, understand the issue, but also may be able to calm the issue in their localities.
Radio Sweden's Mark Cummings and Azara Kairos with that report. And from politics and terrorist threats, we move to art and culture. The old Flemish master Pieter Paul Rubens is getting a fresh new gloss in a major exhibition in Brussels. The Art of Genius exhibition treats visitors to a discovery tour of Rubens' most creative period when he was working in his Antwerp studio in the 1620s and 30s. There's plenty to feast the eyes on, with Rubenesque beauties shimmering alongside intimate sketches of his children, many of them newly restored. But even if you're not a big fan of Baroque art, this lavish show proves there's a lot more to Rubens than meets the eye. Radio Netherlands reporter Vanessa Mox trawled along some of the paintings with exhibition curator Sabine van Sprang.
It's so spontaneous, it's absolutely amazing. Here you can really see the hand of Rubens running over the panel. It's so wonderful.
Sabine van Sprang, you're the co-curator at this exhibition of Rubens. Mm-hmm. We're standing here in front of a small oil painting. It's not a work that I recognize, but it's your favorite. Tell me why it's your favorite.
Yes, it's my favorite because since the restoration is done, the colors that you can see today are so bright and so wonderful that somehow I became totally in love with that painting. With one touch, but really one touch of white, he indicates the eyes. Ah, you can see it. It's really with nothing, the eyes here. You see this little angel puts two little spots of white And the expression of this angel is perfect. I mean, he uses its color. There you see also that he loved Italy. Yeah? Some of the colors are so Italian, I would say, like the oranges, some of the greens. And he brings together Italy and Flanders and makes something new about it. Even if the subject is very serious, the color makes it even a happy subject.
It's not just the paintings that are fascinating about Rubens. His personal life is also incredible. He was a great businessman, a diplomat even. He was an envoy.
Yes, absolutely. And there is this anecdote saying that he was painting and teaching his pupils, and at the same time, somebody else was reading antique texts for him. He was an erudite, but he was at the same time also an amazingly painter. And at the same time, he was a diplomat And
on a personal level, I mean, his relationship to women is, there's some interesting stories there.
Yes, but I think he was a very, very faithful husband. I think he was absolutely astonished by his young wife.
16-year-old second wife.
16-year-old second wife, that's for sure.
A lot of people are put off by Rubens because they think, a Baroque artist, we have these big monumental works, altarpieces, portraits of large Rubenesque women. A lot of people say he doesn't really speak to them.
Yes, exactly. And I think that, as you said, he's also a huge master. So somehow I think that people can be a bit afraid of him. So that was also a bit the idea. Through the drawings, through the sketches, you know, slowly but surely bringing the people through the huge altarpieces. You have also a little guide with some details of the paintings to help the people to see better, to tell them, look at this, look at that detail. It's always the same. When you understand better, you love better. You know, some of the paintings and drawings and sketches are together once again, like they were in the studio for the very first time and maybe also for the very last time. So please take your time to look.
And if that's made you want to see more, Rubens, The Art of Genius is on at the Brussels Royal Museum of Fine Arts until January. And from Brussels, we move to Prague. The largest historical book in the world is to go on show at Prague's Clementinum Gallery this week. The book is known as the Devil's Bible because of the large illustration of the devil inside. This Bible is by no means a satanic work, but contains the Old and New Testaments and other medieval documents, and was written in what is now the Czech Republic in the early 13th century. During the Middle Ages, it was regarded as a wonder of the world. Plundered from Prague by Swedish soldiers during the 30 Years' War, it's now to return to the city temporarily after an absence of over 350 years. Radio Prague's Joshua Singer has more.
The book, which is almost a metre high and half a metre wide, consists entirely of parchment and is made up of 11 sections. Not only is it the biggest, but also the oldest Czech chronicle written in Latin. Accompanying the Bible on display at the exhibition will be detailed descriptions of certain chapters and a history of the book's journey from its origins in Bohemia to its permanent home in Sweden's National Library, from where it is on loan. Vlastimil Ježek is the director of the Czech National Library at the Clementinum.
The Devil's Bible can't be seen by more than 60 people an hour, so we're selling time-allocated tickets, which people can of course order over the internet or buy directly from the Clementinum Gallery. For those who don't have the internet or who don't want to use this medium, it will be possible on Tuesdays and Saturdays to come to the exhibition without time-allocated tickets, but those who do so should expect to wait.
History and legend differ as to exactly how the Bible, also known as the Codex Gigas, came into existence. Historians believe that it was completed in around 1229 in a small Benedictine monastery in Podlasice, and was the life's work of one man. Legend, however, asserts that it is the work of the devil. So the story goes, a Benedictine monk faced death for breaking the code of his order. To save himself from punishment, he sold his soul to Satan in return for creating what he promised would be the biggest manuscript in the world. In modern times, the Czech Republic is only the third country to be loaned the Bible. Vlastimil Ježek again.
Before this exhibition, it has been lent out twice in the last 360 years, once to a major exhibition in New York and once to Berlin before it made its journey back to Prague. I think the fundamental grounds for this loan are that in the first place we have very good relations between the Czech National Library and the Swedish Royal Library. In the second place, we had great help from Czech diplomats. And finally, one can't possibly ignore contribution by Prime Ministers Paroubek and Topolánek, who in the course of Swedish official visits included the issue of the Bible in discussions.
One ticket will allow visitors 10 minutes to view the Bible, which will be on loan until January, when it will return to Sweden.
That was Joshua Singer of Radio Prague bringing us that report. You're listening to Network Europe. And now some sports. The Rugby World Cup hosted in France is now in full swing. And a sport which has never been in the limelight in Poland seems to be gaining a wide range of fans there. John Beauchamp from Polish Radio External Services reports.
There aren't many sports that don't make it to Poland, yet rugby has always been something of a mystery to the local population. The sport is something of a practical non-entity in the minds of Poles, as I found out when I asked some locals what they knew of the game in Poland. Do you know that there was a rugby team in Poland?
I haven't listened about it. It's really new information for me. I haven't heard about any rugby team in Poland.
Did you know that there was a rugby team in Poland?
Yeah, there are probably several. Even in Krakow there is a Juvenia and there is a rugby team. But I don't know any about this sport, so I don't know about the results. I'm not keen on this sport, so...
What can you tell me about Polish rugby?
It's very small in Poland discipline. It's the first Polish discipline. It's a football, it's basketball. Maybe now it's ski jumping. But rugby is not popular. It's, I know in Krakow is Juvenia rugby club. Maybe Warsaw and Budowlani Łódź, everything about this.
What can you tell me about Polish rugby?
Frankly speaking, I've got absolutely no idea about Polish rugby.
What can you tell me about Polish rugby?
Actually nothing. I mean, I heard that somebody made a film about it, but that's all.
However, it's not as bad as all that. Many people in Poland are unaware of the fact that Poland, at the time of this report, ranks 31st in the world rankings given by the IRB, the International Rugby Board. To give you some idea of what that means, the rank puts Poland above those other great rugby-playing nations of Holland, Denmark and Finland, yet below the Germans, Russians and Romanians, the only country from Central Europe to have made it to the World Cup, currently being held in France. In Poland's southern city of Kraków, there too exists a rugby team. I went along to the grounds of Juvenia, on the edge of the Bonnier Meadow in the center of town.
No nie ma u nas takich tradycji jak chociażby w Anglii czy w tych państwach, które się kojarzą.
We don't have the tradition like they have in England or any other country where the sport is established. However, Polish players have caught on to the game and started to play rugby, are also aware of the philosophy behind it, that it's not just a sport, it's something more than that.
Leszek Samel is the manager and head trainer of the Salvator Juvenia Kraków Rugby Club. The club was founded in 1973, forming part of the Juvenia Sports Club. Having been promoted from the Polish second division, Juvenia hovers around sixth in the first division league, which has 10 teams altogether.
Polscy na razie zależy to od tego, jak drużyna sobie radzi w lidze i jaka jest pogoda.
Unfortunately, in Poland, getting spectators depends on where you stand in the league and what the weather's like. In England, I'm sure fans will go whatever the weather. We hope to get to this eventually. When it rains and we're low in the tables, hardly anyone comes. When the sun's out and there's a good match on, though, we've had up to 800 people come to watch. It really depends.
The numbers Mr. Samel gives are not necessarily accurate, though, since tickets to Juvenia matches don't exist, as there is no need for them. Matches are free, and there is no proof what the figures really stand at. He hopes that the ongoing Rugby World Cup will change that, though.
Tak, ja myślę, że doskonała okazja. Sprzedaż teraz tą dyscyplinę w społeczeństwie, jakby można to powiedzieć, siłą rzeczy.
I think it's a good opportunity to sell the sport to Polish society. Poles who have no idea about the sport will have some exposure to it. And because of the nature of things, people will see it on the TV and read articles on the World Cup in the papers. The world is celebrating the Ovular Ball. It should be good for rugby in Poland, and hopefully it will get us more fans too. We had a good season too last year, so hopefully more and more people will start coming to matches.
The Polish Rugby Union celebrated its 50th birthday on the 10th of September this year, and thanks to people like Leszek Samel, rugby is becoming a more popular game. And what with Poland's win over Malta in May and a draw with the French university team earlier in September, things are looking good for Polish rugby. I'm John Beecham, reporting in Kraków for Network Europe.
And we end up in France. In early September, bread and cake prices began to increase in Parisian bakeries. The French baguette is often considered as the indicator for inflation and purchasing power in France. Increases in the price of bread caused politicians to argue for increased competition and for retailers to enforce price rises that they've been looking for some time.
Hello, I'm Aidan O'Donnell, and today I'm at a bakery in central Paris to look at French bread, the baguette. The price of bread is set to increase, and since the average French household spends 400 euros a year on bread and cakes, people are concerned. Behind this is the fact that cereal prices, and so flour prices, are going up all over the world. Here's a summary of the reasons for this around the globe.
Extreme weather conditions have damaged harvests. The biofuel industry is turning American farmers away from wheat production, and global reserves of cereals have not been maintained. Alongside this drop in supply is an increase in demand. Asian countries are now eating more meat and drinking more milk products, and so China and India are now importing vast amounts of cereal for animal feeds.
French bakers are reacting to this by hiking prices. Local bakers have already raised prices, and supermarkets may soon follow suit. Philippe Godard, PR director of France's Federation of Bakers, says an increase in bread prices has been coming because the leap in flour prices has been so extreme.
It's a rise of over 50% in flour prices. Given that cereal prices have doubled in a year, we have rises of 100%. The flour miller who met this rise before us passed these price rises on to us and were obliged to transfer them on to our customers.
But the CLCV, a French consumer group, does not agree. It ran a study to investigate whether these price increases were really justified.
We visited 100 bakeries and collected prices from all around Paris, and we wanted to compare prices from one bakery to another, and we also focused on differences between the different types of bread.
That was Charles Pernat of the CLCV, who wrote the report. He says that bakers are talking about an increase of 5 to 8% in the price of the French baguette because of the increased cost of wheat and flour, but he's not convinced.
In our opinion, this is not a sound argument. Wheat cost only represents 4 to 5% of bread price. Therefore, the current raise in wheat prices should lead to an increase of bread price by 1 to 1.5% and no more. During the last 15 years, wheat has become cheaper while bread prices have raised by 50%.
Philippe Godard of the Bakers Federation agrees that there is more to the rise in bread prices than just the increase in world cereal prices, and cites rises in overheads and in France's minimum wage.
The minimum wage went up 24% between 2002 and 2007. 24%. The cost of living went up by 10%, the price of bread by about 10 or 11% in local bakeries, and about 6% in industrial bakers. So you see, we are within the cost of living. The minimum wage has increased much more than the cost of living.
President Sarkozy had lots to say during his election campaign about purchasing power, so the rise in the price of the baguette may cause him some worry politically. The Prime Minister, François Fillon, has said he aims to fight price rises by encouraging competition between supermarkets. But Serge Papin, head of the supermarket group System U, says that supermarkets are already in stiff competition with each other.
I should remind you that the food budget is only 15% of household expenses. There are expenses which are much bigger. Accommodation, which is 25% of the household budget, or transport, which is 15%. And we feel that competition is working. I believe we're doing our job and that the calls for magic solutions need to stop. Even if it is symbolic, food spending cannot be the solution to the entire problem of purchasing power.
So, when we visit our local bakery, we'll be watching prices carefully, as, of course, will France's politicians. For Network Europe, I'm Aidan O'Donnell.
Well, that brings us to the end of Network Europe for this week. Check details on previous or future programs on our website at www.networkeurope.org, with Network Europe written as one word. Don't forget to tune in same time next week. Enjoy listening to this song, Petit Fleur, composed by Sidney Bechet, lyrics by Fernand Bonifay and performed by Manu Dibango. And from me, Jan van der Made, goodbye.
J'ai caché garde en enfants, l'amour de mes parents, et tous ces clairs matins, faits d'heureux souvenirs. Tu fleuriras toujours.